So this has been cool to be here because exactly 30 years ago this week, I landed at the airport across the street that doesn't exist anymore. Caught a bus from there over to the Lowry Air Force Base, which also doesn't exist anymore. Man, I must be old. And got my technical school training and was only there for a month. It was just a short technical school for the Air Force. I was a supply guy in the Air Force, enlisted guy. And right before that, in boot camp with my little Lackland laser flashlight under the covers at night, during that six-week boot camp, I read the Bible for the first time in my life. Most every night I read a little bit, and I made it through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in that 6 weeks of boot camp. Still didn't know the Lord, but a friend had given me the Bible, had come to know the Lord right before I left for boot camp, and I found myself pretty amazed that the Bible was actually kind of relevant and understandable, because I'd become convinced by others that it was a bunch of religious poetry from the 15th century type lingo and didn't apply to life even if I could understand it. Came here and kind of treaded water spiritually for those 4 weeks or so. Then I went to Langley Air Force Base, where Rich and Justine Roberts currently minister, ran into the navigator, started reading the Bible with Steve Draper, came to Christ there about 3 weeks before my already planned wedding to my high school sweetheart. Went back, shared what happened with her. She prayed to receive Christ about 10 days before our wedding. So we started our Christian life and our married life. Oh, sure. Pretty much simultaneously. So the kind of adventure we've been on for 3 decades started in many ways right here where we are. It's pretty cool. And most of you know, but this is our last event with the military ministries after those 30 years, and we're heading to the Detroit Metro Ministry. So it's just been a really, really cool kind of grand finale with our family here. If you look at this paper called Leadership Axioms, let me tell you where this kind of came from. I wasn't intending to create some sort of seminar or learning lab or workshop or messages or anything on this. About a year and a half ago, I went to the leadership, what's that thing called that Willow Creek puts on? Summit? Is it a leadership summit? Yeah. I'd never been to one of those before. And, of course, they bring in high-powered leaders from every walk of life and even other countries. Some are believers, some are not, from business, government, church, whatever. And it was a great thing, and I got a lot out of it. But the thing that was the takeaway for me from that two-day experience was actually something that Bill Hybels, the guy who kind of founded the thing, said in the kind of kickoff message, which wasn't even really a message. It was kind of a welcome thing. But he mentioned that if we're leading, we probably all are learning important leadership lessons, but most of us don't take the time to crystallize and record them, and which could doom us to repeating the same mistakes over and over again, or at the very least keep us from being able to put in passable form the things that we've learned by trial and terror in leading. So he showed a little book and said, so I've taken to carrying this little book around, and when I realized, hey, that's a leadership lesson I've learned, I go through the struggle to put it in a almost proverb-like form that's catchy, short, concise, captures it, that could be passed on to others and or used just to remind me of important lessons I've learned. So he challenged us to do something like that, and that was my takeaway. Well, about 2 months later, I was driving to meet with Larry Matthews. I do that every Tuesday. And I realized, Lord, I never followed through on that. I'm really sorry. I'm going to get on that. After I prayed that, I pulled in to meet Larry, and Larry gave me a little black book. Said, this is for you. And I said, what's that for? And he said, it's for you to write down all those Tomisms you have. I said, and he knew nothing about the other thing. I said, wow, I was just repenting for not having done that yet, so thanks. And over the next year, 23 axioms came out, most of which were lessons I'd already learned before that, but I'd never struggled to put into words. And that's what these represent. What I'd like to suggest, so I'm just going to give you about 3 or 4 minutes to quickly read through those and circle any one that you would like to talk about at the end of the time. Either because it resonates with you, or you'd like to make a comment, or you're wondering what the heck is he talking about on that one, whatever it may be. So just, you know, put a little star by any that you'd like to talk about. I'll just give you a few moments. All right, well, I'm going to move on in, and if you're still working on it, that's okay. Leadership, it says here, initiating, responding, and deferring. How many of you recognize that I'm restating a fairly familiar old axiom or saying or whatever you want to call it? by that title, leadership, initiating, responding, deferring. All right, I did a good job of disguising it then. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. Only thing I'd like to suggest, by the way that your handout is made is there's blanks in there, and you'll have to listen to know what to write in those blanks. Only thing I want to say, number one there, is I see all three of those things as positive and essential in the realm of leading. I've heard that old thing, lead, follow, or get out of the way. The spin I've always gotten out of it is if you're not leading, that's what matters most. If you can't do that, well, at least follow. If you ain't going to do that, then you're pretty worthless, so just get out of the way. That's kind of the way I've heard it spun. Anybody else kind of taking it that way? I would venture to say all three of them are positive and essential functions of a leader. And we're going to call them so we can get over that negative statement, initiate, respond, and defer. We'll look at them from a when and a how perspective, and we'll trust that the Lord will show you which of them is most crucial for you right now in your current setting. You already looked at the axioms. I already told you about those. See here, key truth, all of us, sorry about that. I'll be kicking you the whole time here, Bernie. Yes, this is true. You don't want to mess with a Navy fighter pilot. Key truth, I really believe this. All of us are leaders, just as all of us are followers. All of us are leaders, and all of us are followers. Now, it's true that some people are particularly gifted as leaders, have a larger capacity than most. It's true that some of us are in formal leadership positions with a title or some amount of authority or something, and others of us are not. But the reality is, all of us are leaders and all of us are followers. A great scripture, we won't look it up right now, but you can just jot it down there next to see, is Matthew 8:5-13. And you're very familiar with it. That's when the centurion asked Jesus to heal his servant. And when Jesus said, yeah, okay, I'll go and heal him. Remember what the centurion said? You don't need to come under my roof. I'm not worthy for that. And besides, I understand how authority works. And how did he say authority worked?
I have people who work for me. I tell them to go and they go. I tell them to come and they come. And I work for others.
It's interesting what he says. He says, I am a man under authority. But then to prove it, he talks about how people obey him. I thought you were trying to say you were under authority. Now you're talking about, it's because it's all wrapped together. We're all leaders. We're all followers. It's just more pronounced or more obvious in some cases than or in some seasons of our life than others. Here's the pattern we're going to look at for all three of these things, whether it be initiating or responding or deferring. We're going to look at passages, persons, and parallels. Passages, some passages from the Bible, examples, meaning the persons, whether they be from Scripture, from history, from our contemporary experience, or all of those. And then parallels, how they really apply to our situations these days. Next thing says, one last thing before we launch. I believe there are stages in a leader's life, just as I believe we're all leaders in one form or another. Our legacy is at stake in understanding and owning where we're at in these four stages in my mind. Stage one is discover. Stage two is deploy. Stage three is divest. And stage four is develop. What I mean by that is discover. You know, I remember when we went to England in 1987, just finished my intern training, my first navigator assignment. I was 27 years old. My wife was 25, and we headed for Europe. Never really been out of the country other than Canada, and being from Detroit, that hardly counted. That was a half-hour drive. But there we were, wide-eyed, excited about this new challenge. And really, we were committed, and we had learned some skills and some knowledge. We had almost no idea of who we were and what we were good at, what we were bad at, what we shouldn't even bother trying. And we went on over. And 7 years later, when we came back, we had a very clear sense of, hey, here's who we are and here's who we're not. Here's what God seems to enjoy using about us. And here's kind of how we ought to go about things. We'll adjust to our context and all that. But we had a sense of who we were. Dwayne and Anna were a big part of kind of coaching and shepherding us through, you know, interpreting our experiences. I like what Paul Stanley says. It's a lie to say that experience is the best teacher. It's evaluated experience that teaches us. Some people have the same experiences over and over and they never learn. But having someone that you can talk that through with and learn as you go. So discovering, that was us in England. Deploying is to refocus based on what you've learned in stage one there, discovering, and consciously make it a priority to give yourself to the niche or niches you've discovered about how God likes to use you versus kind of wasting your time doing some things that isn't blessing anybody else and it isn't blessing you to do it. I mean, you always got to be willing to do something you're not gifted at, but to focus, to major on that which you've discovered. The third stage begins to get a little hard for us, and that's divesting our leadership, our influence, or our authority. Learning to discern God's timing, to step aside, and I put to reclaim my intrinsic identity. Because unfortunately what happens to us as human beings, and I think this is probably more of a danger for us males, is that we begin to find our sense of identity in our influence or in our impact. And one of the reasons God wants us to sort of turn aside certain leadership roles or whatever is because He wants to remind us that He loves us for who we are, not what we do or our title or our impact. And sometimes you're moving from one kind of stage or type of leadership or title or whatever it may be to another. It's not that you're done leading, but you're divesting yourself of a particular responsibility. And you've probably all seen someone who stayed in a role too long. And you notice one of my axioms there. A man or a person who stays in his leadership role too long slowly begins to become a caricature of himself in the eyes of those he leads. So, you remember what a caricature is in like a political cartoon? Yeah. They take your actual features and exaggerate them. Okay. So my strengths and weaknesses, my idiosyncrasies, whatever you want to call it, begin to get more and more exaggerated in people's minds. And so what they now remember of me or think of me is actually a caricature of me because I didn't leave when I should have left. I didn't lay the mantle down when I should have. Fourthly is develop, to deliberately invest in and empower younger leaders in my place. And, you know, I think it's Bobby Clinton and Paul Stanley in their book called that afterglow. And precious few people, men or women, do a good job of being intentional about that. They sort of think, okay, well, if I don't have a title anymore or whatever, I guess I'm in the bleachers. And it's just a tragedy when that happens. You know, we know Titus 2, 4, and 5. Man, in the body of Christ, so few women do that. And it's really not a much better scorecard for the men. It's kind of like if I don't have this title or this huge sort of thing I'm in charge of, then I guess I'm nobody and we retreat to being a couch potato or something. But it's probably our greatest influence can be later on when we're sort of done with our direct leadership. Okay, questions or thoughts before we launch on into the first one, initiating? Okay. Well, we'll move into that then. Under initiating, which I put in parentheses next to their Roman numeral 2, I put a few little kind of words that I think of as synonyms or at least related concepts to this initiating. And that would be what we would tend to think of when we think of leading, directing, mobilizing, that kind of thing. Taking the initiative. Leaders see a need or a cause and they begin immediately mobilizing people to meet that need or to serve that cause. They take the initiative. They start making things happen. They articulate. Now, this is a weird word that actually isn't a word, I'm pretty sure, but I'm going to use it. I guess you can make it hyphenated, then it's two legit words. They articulate the compellingness of that need or cause and our ability to do something about it, to meet it. Have you all been around a leader like that? They're able to just help you see the need and see how you could be part of being strategic and meeting that need or furthering that cause or causing that movement, as the case may be.
Yeah, it is
a lot to do with that. Yeah, casting vision. Both vision for what the need or the enterprise or the movement is or should be, and giving you personal vision that you have what it takes. We need you. You could do this. You could have a big part in this. Good leaders, we'll talk about that more a little bit later, but good leaders really help me to believe there's more inside of me that I could offer than I myself might see on my own. Second thing, bullet there says they recruit by articulation of the need, it's important, and others' potential part in meeting that. They formulate or facilitate ideas. They either come up with them themselves or they create an environment and welcome others speaking to it so others can come up with ideas for how to effectively respond to that need. And we're talking kind of strategy there. They articulate what is, the vision for what could be, and the path to get there. I don't want to erase Chris till he sees it, so I'll erase me. My daughter came in here and had a little fun with the board here. But you've probably all seen this before. A leader is good at articulating what should be or could be and what is, and a realistic but compellingly exciting way to get from where we are to where we could be or should be. Does that make sense? If you're missing the ability to articulate in a clear and compelling way any one of those three things, then to that degree, your leadership is a little less compelling in this initiating phase. Does that make sense? Recruit. No problem. If you ask me to repeat something, that means somebody's listening. So you can do that all day. Leaders tend to inspire others. Here's kind of that vision piece like you were mentioning, Melissa. They inspire them personally, corporately, and missionally. Personally, in the sense they call out of folks more than they knew themselves was inside of them. Did you ever see Mr. Holland's Opus, that movie? Remember what he did with that redhead gal, the girl who couldn't play clarinet? They show him just painfully meeting with her hours before school each day. And there's really little reason for hope in her mind or anybody that's paying attention that she's ever going to get this. But in the end, he steals her music. He says, close your eyes and play the sunset for me. And nobody's more shocked than her. And then she ends up becoming the governor. You know, I mean, a little bit of a stretch, a little bit idealistic, but I love what they're illustrating there, that leaders do that. I remember when I was brand new on intern staff with the Navigators, I put out my first newsletter ever put out. I was 25 years old, really full of doubt of whether I could pull this thing off. And I got a copy of my own newsletter back in the mail from two people, Bob Lewis and Paul Stanley, two kind of spiritual heroes of mine. And what they did is they read my newsletter, they prayed over it, and they just wrote a sentence or two on it and sent it back. I lived on that for 2 years, man. Paul Stanley, here's what he said. This is exciting. Many are following. Keep going. Oh, man, that meant the world to me. He didn't say that much, but meant a lot to me. Called more out of me than I knew was in there. Corporately, they help people to understand the potential impact they can make together as well as their personal part in the whole enterprise. And missionally, another made-up word on my part, I think, I put the cruciality of the cause. You know, they help us believe in the merit, the nobility of the cause they're recruiting us to play a part in. Leaders are intentional and proactive, page 2, about what's needed next. Both for the mission and for the man. And when I say man, I mean Adam, you know, the general term for man, not males. But see, if I said persons or something like that, it just doesn't go with mission. It's got to be an M. They are obsessed with the future when it comes to the mission. Obsessed with the future, looking down the road, always considering the next step, these initiating type leaders. And for the person, they're as concerned with developing people as they are accomplishing goals. Often we hear those two concepts pitted against one another as though they're in conflict with one another. But in my mind, I think ideally anything that moves the mission forward ought to be good for the person who's playing a part as well. I don't see development of the persons and accomplishment of the mission as intention or working against one another necessarily. If they are, I must be really lazy and getting a little bit too expedient about how to accomplish the mission, right? So I think good leaders are proactive and intentional as they initiate, both for the sake of developing people and accomplishing their common mission. Here's a key truth, and I learned this one from Phil Parton. I don't think I put it on my axioms, or if I did, I probably put Phil's name next to it because it wasn't mine. But he says this one, "My authority does its best work if I never choose to use it." My authority does my best work if I never choose to use it. And he uses five-card poker as an example. He says, in your hand, you got four influence cards and one ace of trump. The ace of trump is your authority. You could make them do what needs to be done. But that ace of trump does its best work if it never gets laid on the table. Because everyone knows you've got it, and you're choosing not to use it. You're choosing to influence their heart rather than use power to make them do what you think the right thing is. Really, once you lay that card on the table, you win that hand, but you're done. You're cooked. A good example of that is when we first moved to Ohio, middle of the night, my wife had one of her classic women's intuition moments and woke me up about 3 in the morning and said, "I don't think Lydia is here," one of our kids. "It's 3 in the morning, honey." And she lives 2 floors below us. She was in the finished basement. We are not on the main level. "Did you hear something?" "No, I just feel like she's not here." So I get up, kind of ticked off. Wander down the steps, grumbling to myself. Get down, flip on Lydia's bedroom light, and I'll be. My wife was right. She wasn't there. Had to eat a little crow. So then I went back up and said, "She's not here." And that caused her to really panic. So I said, "I'll figure it out." So I went outside. It was kind of like a nice, warm fall night. And I could hear across the street. We had a long driveway, 2.5-acre lot there in Ohio. But I could hear across the street kids, and I could see a bonfire. And I walked out to the end of my driveway and kind of hid in the bushes and looked across the street. And there was about 100 kids coming and going in cars and drinking beer and a bonfire. My daughter was in the 7th grade at this point. She was one of them over there. Then, to my amazement, I looked and I could see with the lights on in the house that the mother and father were home, walking around in the house, allowing underage kids to go nuts and party at their house and drink beer and come and go in cars. And I thought, boy, is that ever stupid, you know, from every angle. Well, you know what my wife wanted me to do after we brought Lydia home and grounded her and all that? Guess what my wife wanted me to do?
Call the police.
These are our new neighbors.
We have authority.
We can use authority. We can make them stop doing this. I said, honey, if I call the police on our new neighbors, our influence in our life is over before it started. And she didn't really agree with me at the time. But I really believed that with all my heart. If I call the police on them right now, yes, it'll make them stop doing a wrong thing, but it's over. We have no more influence in their lives. So I chose to get to know them slowly and build a little rapport. And I haven't seen another party over there like that, but I don't know if it had anything to do with my influence. Anyway. So the next thing it says, another example of that is a policeman. The gun that he carries is most helpful when, what do you think that says? When it stays in the holster. Stays in the holster. Once he pulls that thing out, he's got to be willing to use it. And really, there's no more influence of that life. That person is now an enemy, not someone who he's going to have any impact on changing their thinking. And you see that on one of my axioms, number 3 there, it says, God gives me a position, an authority role or whatever, to broaden my platform, not my power. The correct usage, I think, of authority or title or whatever it may be, is that just kind of gets your foot in the door. It gives you a head start or it's a catalyst to people considering whether or not they should listen to you. Does that make sense? Yeah, you were going to say something?
I worked for the training wing in Kingsville, and I worked for the wing commander. There were 2 squadrons, and they worked for the wing commander also. My assistant and I looked at the situation. We were a little behind. We became convinced that what we needed to do was work that Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We went into the boss and talked to the wing commander and convinced him that our plan was the best plan. He said, go sell it to the squadron commanders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went to one and I went to the other one. I worked on helping them see the evidence I saw and come to my conclusion. I called it tact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He went in and said, this is what we think you need to do. We already talked to the boss. You have to do it. And it didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, once it became, we talked to the boss and we won and you lost.
Yeah.
The boss had to decide whether to take away any ownership that the squadron commander had or whether to let him own his squadron.
That's right.
And do something different.
Yeah, so good. Great example. You know, when I got put on the MLT, the leadership team of our military ministries, I thought, okay, well, that means if I go visit an area I'm supposedly overseeing, they'll probably let me in. That's all it means. You know, and then after that, they'll decide if they should actually open their heart to my influence or just sort of put up with me until a new pharaoh should come. You know, so I didn't ever go in. I hope Dwayne would back me up on this. I never went into any of those situations thinking, I'm in charge and here's what we got. That just doesn't accomplish anything good as it comes to shaping other human hearts. Good. Great example, Bernie. Real leadership influence, I think. Yes. In other words, well, that's what we were just expounding on. When you get authority, when you get a title, when you get a position, it broadens your platform, the chance that you get an opportunity to potentially influence more people. Because, you know, if there's a new general at a base, you know, there's two tacks he can take. One is the let me pee on everything around here, make sure you knew there's no sheriff in town. That's not a very influential leader. He might control things and so forth. The other is to come in humbly and say, I can't believe I have this honor of leading people like you. I'd like to get to know you. Help me understand what it is around here so I don't ruin anything. And which kind of leader ends up being beloved and shaping lives? It's the second one, not the first, right? So that's what I'm talking about.
It essentially provides access, not loyalty.
Yeah, there you go. You still have to earn trust, loyalty, respect, but it gives you access. It gives you an opportunity. It opens the door. That's very well said. Very well said. Remind me of your name, Kevin. Kevin. Okay. Thanks, Kevin. That's a good comment. Real leadership influence, E, there comes from one or more of the following things, in my opinion. You see what they are: ideas, passion, character, example, vision, and our ability to articulate, especially number 1, 2, and 5. Ideas, passion, vision. Character is the primary means by which you gain trust when people become convinced they can trust your heart. You heard the old thing, you know, no one cares how much you know till they know how much you care. And when they know they can trust you, man, trust is king among all leadership ammunition to influence others. Trust is king. And trust has to be earned. It cannot be demanded, no matter how much authority you think you have. Okay, the next thing, F says, leaders listen. Now, you might think this is funny that I have that under initiate instead of respond, but I think it's an important part of being a good initiator because you have to listen and understand what people need and long for before you can know what to initiate or how to initiate or when to initiate. Does that make sense? I'll share with you something that my son said to me on the way back from Europe. My son, Silas, he is now 20, he turns 25 this month. At the time I took him to Europe on this ministry trip, he had just turned 21. He was excited about going with me because he hadn't been back to England since we left there when he was 8 years old. My son was not walking with God at this time. But I have a good relationship with him. He respects me. He told me one night that, Dad, you are my hero. I do want to be like you someday, but I just am not ready to give Jesus control. So I'm very grateful for that. It's kind of heartbreaking that he's not walking with God, but it's a good relationship. So I took him with me, and I was excited about this. Well, for 10 or 12 days we went throughout Europe. I spoke at this conference in Rome, you know, serious suffering for Jesus. Visited the staff in Germany and so forth, and went to England and visited some people who had been in our ministry years ago that chose to stay living in England, and this, that, and the other. Well, it was probably 10 plane flights, you know, on Ryanair and all this stuff all around Europe. So we're finally coming back after nearly 2 weeks in Europe, and we're bushed. And, you know, my son hadn't lived with us for a couple of years by then, and I was wondering what it was going to be like just to room together and be together that much for that long, whether he'd just go nuts. But he was great. So we're on this plane getting ready to cross the ocean back, and my son's sitting next to me, and he goes like this. So I shook his hand. He said, "This was the best, Dad." I said, "Oh, well, I'm glad you liked it. I liked it too." And I'll get a little choked up telling you this next part, as I did when he told me. He said this to me, and then he turned over and went to sleep, and I stood there crying next to him. But he said, "You know, Dad, I don't know if I could do what you do. I see what you do." I said, "Oh, really? What do I do?" He goes, "You listen to people, and they line up to have you listen to them." That was about the most affirming thing he could say to me, because he'd been there all the way through that ministry, and what struck him was that I listened to people. You know, he didn't say, "Man, no, sure, we're great messages are preached at the conference." He said, "Man, you listen to people. I don't know if I could do that." And apart from Christ, he couldn't, and neither could I. Well, that was really a powerful lesson for me. Examples in Scripture of these kinds of initiative-type leaders. I put down Paul, Nehemiah, David, Jesus. Of course, Jesus makes every list, but I'm sure you can think of some others in Scripture. People that were marked especially by this particular kind of leadership contribution of initiating, directing.
Can you say that list again?
Yes, I put Paul, Nehemiah, King David, and Jesus. That's not an exhaustive list. We could probably come up with 10 more at least. But those are the ones that struck me. Perhaps you'll want to write down a couple more that come to your mind. And then some examples in history. I thought of Martin Luther King. There was a saying about the primary core leadership of the American Revolution. Three people. And their nickname was the tongue, the pen, and the sword. You ever hear those people? You know who that was? Close. Washington and Jefferson were two of them. And which ones do you think they were?
The sword was Washington.
The pen. Huh? Madison? No. Patrick Henry was the tongue. He was the orator who could fire everybody up for the cause. And Jefferson was the one who could record it in writing in ways that was compelling and clarifying. And Washington was the one who went out and fought the actual battles. The tongue, the pen, and the sword. I think of those guys as great initiating leaders, although in different ways. They kind of illustrate, too, that we're different in how we do that. Hey, Chris. My daughter made a picture of you.
That's awesome.
Now, let me just tell you, and you can put these by the axioms if you care to on the axiom list. The following axioms, in my mind, deal particularly with initiating. So if you care to, you can put a little I next to each one of these. Numbers 1 through 4. 1, 2, 3, and 4. Numbers 6 and 7. These particular of my axioms over here relate to initiating in my mind. Numbers 1 through 4. Numbers 6 and 7. Number 9. Numbers 11 through 13, number 16, and numbers 19 through 21. In short, 14 of the 23 axioms really deal with initiating in my mind. So here's my question for each of us on J. Where do I need to step up? A little more intentionally. Where do I need to step up? Are there areas of my life in leadership right now where I need to be a little bit more intentional about taking initiative, about providing direction? It's really interesting as I've been driving up to get to know the team in Detroit that has somehow smoked a little crack and been stupid enough to ask me to come up and be their leader. Some of them are kind of intimidating guys and gals. They're older than I am. They've been fruitful. They were making disciples while I was still wetting the bed, you know. And a couple of them have said, without me actually asking them for any such feedback, I've met with them, and they've said, "Listen, don't be afraid to direct us. We'll follow. We want that." I was kind of intimidating in a new way. But they actually said to me, don't be afraid to lead us. Take the lead. Don't shrink back. We want to be led. We'll follow you. Kind of humbling. But it is true that if we do this in the right sort of way, people are blessed by it. They want, God made us that way. All right, any comments before we move on to page 3 of the 4 pages, which is called Responding?
Tom, just a thought that comes to mind today, that the example from history, one of those, sometimes, you know, the picture we have is somebody that's really upfront. Somebody like Mother Teresa is one that had a tremendous leadership aspect in listening, but not one that you would probably think of in terms of some bearing issues.
Yeah, real forceful or ultra gifted or whatever. Yeah, you're right. But who had more influence than her? Yeah, that's a good observation, Dwayne. Okay, let's move into this next phase. By the way, Chris, you can get the notes that you missed from your wife, but this workshop title is really an old saying in disguise. It's called Initiating, Responding, and Deferring, which is lead, follower, get out of the way. Responding. In parentheses next to Roman numeral 3 there, I put just, again, a few three little kind of related terms or maybe even synonyms. Follow, support, complement. Follow, support, or complement. You remember that on the first page in the introductory remarks, I said, I believe all of us are leaders just as all of us are followers. Because all of us have authority and all of us are under authority, how I follow will profoundly affect my leading. Those who I'd like to see following me are going to watch how I follow those who are above me as part of their decision on to what degree they want to follow me. Folks will not follow me if they see me not following. It works like in a home, like a rebellious mom. A mom who greatly disparages and disrespects and refuses to follow her husband will find herself with a bunch of kids refusing to follow her. You've all probably seen it. If you're like us, you maybe have done it. You know, I mean, because we all have our bad moments. But to the degree I'm down, like one of the things that my mother used to do, and I, by the way, I have good parents, good mom, but I remember this caused me distress. She would be talking to her mother, my grandmother, on the phone. And after she got done, she would hang up and basically say a bunch of snide things about her mother to my dad. You know, basically complain about what an idiot her mother was, which is very disrespectful. Well, it's probably normal, you know. Her mom was getting older and so on and so forth and doing a couple of crazy things and thinking a little weird. But it was kind of distressing for me as a little kid, like this woman I'm supposed to respect and follow isn't respecting the one above her in a sense. Does that make sense? And the same is true, like if you saw Tom Hanks in Private Ryan, that's the next little quote there. Remember when the guys are in Saving Private Ryan, they're walking and they're complaining about what a stupid mission it is. And then they ask him what he thinks of it. He's their little platoon commander there. He says, I think it's an excellent mission. And they think, oh, come on. And then he says, well, if I did think it was stupid, I wouldn't tell you. Because complaints go up, never down the chain of command. This was the principle he knew he was articulating. If I bellyache about those over me, it will erode my leadership over you. That's the way that works. So he had to be a good follower if he wanted to be an effective leader. It's true in every realm, including my family. If you have a family, pretty big question to ask that would immediately potentially help out your own influence and leadership is, how do my spouse and kids view my followership? How do they see me as a follower of those who lead me? To the degree that's a, you know, if I'm getting a C- in following in their eyes, those who lead me, I'm not getting any better than a C- on them following me. It's just kind of the way it works.
It's true in individual areas, and it's true overall.
It really is. It really, really is. And yet it's something we could fail to sort of make the connection on in everyday life, in the trenches. I mean, you just kind of get sloppy in life, can't you?
My kids never to get driver's licenses because I don't drive very well.
There you go. You knew the example they'd grown up with, huh? You know, It's profound how we influence our kids without realizing it. Yeah, go ahead.
Tom, probably some of you have seen the thing about Shackelford. I don't know if you've ever seen that or not, but it's a great deal. But the thing that he did in that was is that among the men, Shackelford was the guy that was took a boat and was a sail, and actually they spent
over a year.
Yeah, they spent over a year and actually got back. And anybody that complained, he had him sleep with him in his tent.
Mm.
So that he wouldn't influence the rest of the people that are negative
in
a negative direction.
Huh.
And he could influence them.
Ah, excellent, yeah. It is like almost like a cancer, isn't it? And the influence we have on our some of the people around us, including our own children, is subtle but not so subtle. One time I was driving in Annapolis. We had our 15-passenger van. It was when we were at the zenith of our family size. We only have 6 of us living at home now, but we had 11 then. All 9 of our kids were still at home, and we're driving the 15-passenger van. And a guy pulls out in front of me. I slam on the brakes. And I'm very proud of myself because I didn't say anything. But I didn't have to, because about 5 seconds later, I heard my 3-year-old son say, "That guy was a jerk, wasn't he, Dad?" So even at a time when I was holding my tongue, I was reminded of the times I hadn't. And so if my kids see me blowing off rules and laws like the speed limit or taxes or whatever it may be, that's going to erode my own sense of respect and authority with them. Just as we already mentioned, the talking disrespectfully about my bosses, my parents, my whatever it may be. B there says, even in realms of my being the leader in a given context, I still must follow my followers well at times. Secure leaders attract strong leaders as their followers. Controlling leaders, not so much. If a leader is insecure and demands control and kind of wears his authority on his sleeve, he will not recruit leaders as his followers. He'll recruit insecure people who need to belong to something and yes men and that kind of thing. Paul Stanley gave me a great illustration some of you may have heard before, that a leader is like the center pole in a tent. And if he's strong and secure and tall, so to speak, not physically, but stands tall, then leader types will look and say, you know what, there's room for me in that tent. I can go in there and I'll have some freedom to do some leading myself under that leader. But if the leader is insecure and sort of small inside, then a leader looks in that tent and says, there ain't room in there for me. I ain't going in there. And you end up with only weak people and compliant people for your followers. But if you're secure and you're willing to give away the power and let them do some of the leading, including leading you at times, then you'll attract leaders as your followers. Does that make sense? Anybody unclear on that? Was I clear as mud on that one? I need to allow followers to, quote unquote, lead us all in areas of their specialty. Need to delegate to them. Ron Holacek was very good at that as the MLT director in at least the last chapter. I wasn't there the first 5 or 6 years, but I was the last 5 years. And he was very good that when something came on the table that needed to be discussed or decided upon or enacted, he'd look around the table and say, I think it was his first instinct, who on this team is more gifted than I am at this? And he'd basically turn over the meeting to that person and say, Tom, would you lead us on this? This is your thing. And, you know, rather than just, Tom, what do you got to say? But don't forget, I'm still in charge. You know, it wasn't that at all. So, yes?
How does this work with the young leaders that you're trying to develop? Because sometimes they're not. I understand if you're working with mature people, but mm-hmm. immature people, and their way to learn is by making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you give them freedom, but still guide them, but not be controlling?
Yeah, that's a good question, Catherine. I don't have a quick and easy formula, but my perception, I'm sure some other folks, including Bernie, will have some thoughts too, is my perception is you're exactly right about something you said. They learn by making mistakes, so you got to give them the freedom to make some. But then also being a sounding board and a coach after the fact. And it's really interesting to develop people. It's kind of humbling. You don't have to have any answers. You just have to ask good questions. You know, it's like you say to them after they did it, like, Well, what were your objectives when we went into this? Well, there were this, this, and this. And how did that go? Which of them do you feel like accomplished? Well, this one, okay. This one, oh. That one, so-so. Well, why is that? Why do you say that? You know, and blah, blah, blah. Well, what would you do differently if you were doing it again today? And, you know, you've just developed them tremendously, and you didn't give them any answers. You helped them discover and sort of crystallize what they'd learned by their experience. But also, there's still, you know, my son, who isn't walking with the Lord that I was just talking about, I still let him lead me in certain areas that he's better at than I. He's passionate. He's gifted. I say, man, I'm lousy at that. Can you show me how you do that? And it might be stuff that's kind of directly related to leading people. You know, he's just better at it than I am, that particular thing. So I think to get good followers, you got to do some following of them, even when you're... I mean, my son would see me as the leader in our relationship more than him. But I very intentionally let him lead me sometimes on some things. Does that make sense? Yeah, what were you going to say, Bernie?
I think that you have to have boundaries that are pretty big, mm-hmm. and have trained people to operate within more narrow boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to let them get to the boundaries that they're allowed to operate within and go over those.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, we need to change this or that. And,
mm-hmm.
and you need to give them enough training that they don't do that very often, because that's a failure.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But they do need to make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Well, there's a lot of things in life that's a matter of degree. I have a whole bunch of these illustrations that I've made up on my computer, and I've never shown them to anybody but me, but they just help me think. Most things in life, there's a path, a road we want to be on. Let's say that I should have made that dotted. That's the center line. And then there's a ditch on each side of the road. So two good things. This is a great microcosm of the leadership of my wife and the leadership of me and our family. We tend to, whichever side of the road I'm on, she's usually on the other. So I tend to give a lot of freedom. She tends to more err on the side of protection. Well, if she goes too far with her, you know, both of these are legitimate and helpful. If she goes too far with her protection, it becomes control. If I go too far with my freedom, it kind of becomes abdicating or deserting them, leaving them out with no protection whatsoever. Does that make sense? And the same is true in this regard. Yeah, Chris?
Perfection or protection?
Protection. Protection. Protection is a legitimate need to address, as is freedom, their intention with each other. But both these ditches are not legitimate. That's bad. Does that make sense? And, you know, what we usually do in life is we find ourselves in one ditch, and in order to get out of a ditch, you have to aim at a right angle and gun it. Go over the other one. That's right. Lauren Sandy used to say, the only time we seem to be balanced is when we're passing through briefly on our way to the other extreme. Following well prepares me and promotes me as a leader. Luke 16:12, you're all familiar with. You must be faithful in that which is another's before you'll be trusted with your own treasure. And ultimately, I find that responding to leaders over me or letting those I lead me at times is an issue of faith and God's sovereignty. My authorities are from the Lord. You know, David was the great example on that. Daniel was another one in the scriptures where, David had a dirtbag for a leader, King Saul. And yet, because he was his leader, he believed he was the Lord's anointed in his life, and he refused to act disrespectfully or even to just pay him back for the wrong he'd done him. And God blessed them for that. And you know, the people were watching, weren't they? And they were amazed, and their respect for David just went up. So that when the day come for him to be the leader, man, they were wholehearted in following him.
David was loyal in the most difficult circumstances, making people that he wanted to be loyal
to him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
His loyalty was to God and God's laws,
mm-hmm.
which said,
you relate to an authority in a certain way. Yeah, that's exactly right. Some examples in Scripture of good responders. I put down 11 of the 12 apostles. David makes the list again. Daniel, I already mentioned him. Another great one was Joshua. How beautifully he served and responded to and followed the leadership of Moses in such a way that when Moses died, There was no doubt in anyone's mind who the new leader was. Of course, God made it extra clear by saying so, but I think that was just so natural. He had earned that. Who are some examples in history who were so good at deferring, either when they were in leadership or before they were in leadership, that it just really greatly enhanced? Alexander Haig. Yeah, I'm in charge here. Yeah. Some of the things we're going to say, only us old people will laugh because you don't know what we're talking about. poor guy just died. We just joked about him. Okay. Who's a couple people in history you can remember that their excellence in responding or following the leadership of others either characterized their own effective leadership or set them up to become leaders because they were so good at that? Anybody come to mind? I've just got a couple people down, and there's 50 other ones you can come up with easily. Or none. You might come up with none. I wrote down two. John Adams is a great one. I'm reading the book about his life right now. When I ordered it, I didn't know it would need a wheelbarrow because it was so thick. I'm reading it kind of slowly. You know, the one I should have held out for the HBO miniseries, but it's like that thick. But man, that guy served under Washington and others for a long, long time. What's that?
I was trying to think of his name. But
yeah.
You
were thinking of him, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he just never clamored to be in charge. He served and led well under other leaders, and eventually he became the President of the United States, as did his son. How about a leader that actually was probably one of his most gifted contributions while he was a supreme leader? Was his ability to defer to those he was leading and negotiate with them and sort of affirm them and help their egos along so they would cooperate. I'm giving more and more hints.
Lincoln.
Huh?
Lincoln.
Lincoln? Yeah, Lincoln was good at that. I was thinking of Eisenhower.
I thought you were thinking of a military leader.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that...
Eisenhower's great contribution was being able to keep all those gigantic egos working together. And he would kind of privately get away. And another one who did that was Reagan. One of the things Reagan did, I haven't seen another president even attempt it, let alone do it so effectively as he did. When there was a vote coming up in Congress, starting a few days before that vote, there was a motorcade of cars coming one after another of congressmen and or senators to meet with the president one-on-one. Do you remember how he used to do that? And they would interview him on the way out, you know, and say, you know, on the way in, you know, like some Democratic senator, like, I don't care what he says to me, I'm not voting for this or whatever. And then they go in and come out, and, well, what do you think now? Well, gee, he has a way. I don't know, you know. And I heard that he would just say, John, we need your vote. What's it going to take? What can I do for you so that you'll help me out with this? You know, just there's a lot of deferring and giving and taking there. Okay. Axioms number 5, 14. These you can put an R next to if you want to on your little axiom list, because I think they have to do with responding. Number 5, number 14, and number 17 and 18. You remember at the end of initiating, my question to each of us was, where do I need to step up a little more intentionally? On this one, I'm going to ask it a little different. Where do I need to fall in line a little more wholeheartedly? First, where do I need to step up a little more intentionally? This one, where do I need to fall in line a little more wholeheartedly? Does that make sense? Questions or thoughts before we move on to the final deal on this idea of responding? I saw that yawn. Careful, those are contagious. It's a good thing you're in the back. That's right. All right, deferring, the final one. Remember in our old-fashioned and unfortunately negative spin statement, lead, follower, get out of the way. This is about getting out of the way, but it's a very positive thing. Every leadership role is temporary. Every leadership role is temporary. Number one, I must guard against it becoming part of my identity. I must guard against it becoming part of my identity. We've all seen leaders that it crept into their soul and they began to think of themselves as part of who they were, as their title or their budget or whatever, and they almost don't know what to do with their life when that goes away. Parents even do it. When their kids are gone and there's an empty nest, they don't have any more purpose for living or reason for relating to their spouse. It's like, oops, that became your identity. Yeah.
We had a pastor who was a very gifted church planner.
Mm-hmm.
Very gifted. Planted a great church, caught a vision, got people surrounded it, and it was healthy, and mm-hmm. it was starting to grow. But his gifting was not in maintaining a church, his gifting was planning.
Mm.
But the church became so much of who he was, he couldn't let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of years, the church just died. He tried to replant it essentially 3 times.
Because he wouldn't let go of that role when it was...
Day, he's still trying to replant it.
Oh, man.
Church in College Springs, and churches have grown past 30 or 40 people.
Yeah, and I want to say that's a great example. Obviously, by that I mean a tragic but perfect example. When you don't step out, you know... Bill Crabb, Larry Crabb's older brother, who's now with the Lord, he said, this is so insidious, it's there more than you know it is. He retired from the Air Force as a colonel. And he said for the first several months after he retired, he got angry when he got mail addressed to Mr. Bill Crabb. I'm Colonel Bill Crabb, I'm not Mr. Cole. You know, and it shocked him. Like, wow, I can't believe that riled me up. It became part of my identity.
I might be jumping ahead of you, Tom, if I am, I apologize. But how does one know when it's time to move on?
It's a great question. Can you help me make sure I don't forget that at the end of this page? Actually, before we get to the application, remind me of that. Good question. Because you know what? Sometimes you're the last one to know. The short answer is make sure others know that you really, really want them to tell you. Because we'll talk more about that. But the second thing I wrote there is I must be proactive and intentional about how and when to step aside. How and when to step aside. I must be proactive and intentional, that's the first blank, about how and when to step aside from a leadership role. And I know all that does is intensify your question, but we'll get there. Number three, I must be looking to, quote unquote, work myself out of a job. One of the things I love about the Navigators when it comes to their foreign missions is they're one of the few missionary agencies I've run into who goes into a country and their express goal is, when can we make sure there's no Americans here and let them own it? And we even, organizationally, they have their own organization. We call it a worldwide what?
Partnership.
Do you know that Mike Trenier has no authority over Navigators in any other country? He's got tons of influence, but no one has to obey him. There's no organization that they're part of, that he's over them in an organizational sort of way. Now, he may exert his influence at times, but they made a decision way back under Jerry White, if not even maybe the end part of Lauren Sandy's. I think it was under Jerry in the early days of Jerry White, in the late 80s, early 90s, that they decided to divest themselves of authority and go with influence in leading the worldwide work of the Navigators. That's great.
There are national Navigators that are incorporated mm-hmm. in other countries
mm-hmm.
that have no legal link.
Yep, to us. And again, we go there thinking, hopefully in a generation or two, it'll be nationals that are in charge of this thing, and they won't even need us, our help. Whereas every other mission agency in history has tended to, you know, still have their fingers on that thing.
You're going to be the
follower. Yeah, we'll lead, you follow, even though it's your country. Number four, the cause and the need is bigger than me and my part. One of the things that I think is true of a leader is that you have a contribution to make for a season. And then you sort of get to a point, and this is getting at your question a little, RJ, where you realize, you know, I've kind of put my mark on this thing. And now we're sort of treading water. And if it's going to go to the next level God wants to take it, it's time for me to get out of the way. Because I can't really do much more than what I've already done. Remind me, I'll give you a story about our time at the Naval Academy as an example of that. The best leaders are looking, it says, to develop and empower other younger leaders. It was a success in Moses' life and a failure in Joshua's. You all know that when Moses died, as we mentioned earlier, everybody knew Joshua was the one that was groomed and ready to go. When Joshua died, we got the book of Judges. There's absolutely, you can't pick out a single name that's even a maybe replacement for Joshua as you read his whole life. He was a brilliant leader in almost every other way.
But,
yeah, because he had not prepared another leader. They give authority away freely, good leaders do, which causes people to give them more. See that blank on number two, B2? They give authority away freely, which causes people, i.e. their followers, to give them more. Greatest example I know of in history of this is George Washington. Every time they gave George Washington authority, he took it, first off, he took it kind of reluctantly. Not in the sense that he wasn't sure he could do it, but he didn't have any deep need to do it. He didn't really care about the title. And so they made him the commander of the Continental Armies, you know. And he says, well, why me? First they had to convince him why they wanted him. Okay, and what are my objectives? And what is my tenure? And what is my authority? What are my responsibilities? He clarified all that. When the mission as he had negotiated with them was accomplished, it was George Washington himself who thought it was very important to have a very public ceremony where he resigned his commission and went back to being a farmer. Because all kinds of people were clamoring to make him the king or whatever. And he thought, well, let me make this real clear that the civilians are over the military. And also make it very clear, I'm done. And in Annapolis, Maryland, where we lived for 9 years, there's a mannequin in the room where he did that, and the uniform he wore that day is on that mannequin, where he met with they were states by then. I don't know if they were states yet or not, or colonies. He met with the representatives for the 13 colonies, and he resigned his commission, gave up his rank, went back to being a farmer. Well, not long after that, of course, they drafted him to run for president. Really didn't want to. Well, okay, what's my mission? What am I supposed to accomplish? Why me? I went through all that again. He gets that position. They barely convince him to run a second time. Third time, there wasn't anything that could convince him. Went back to being a farmer.
And so, several years? It seems like...
Several years between the two?
Between the...
General and president? Yeah, yeah. And what happened, and those are just the two big ones we know about, but he kept doing that over and over again. He kept saying, no, you can have your authority back. I'm done. I did what you asked me to do. What would that make people want to do? We'll give you even more authority, since we can see that you don't need it for your own personal sense of identity, then we'll trust you with even more. Yeah.
Think about James Dobson.
Yeah.
I don't know if he stayed too long or not, but I was really shocked when I heard that he was stepping down from Focus, being in charge of Focus. It just boggled my mind because he was Focus.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's Focus family / James Dobson.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when was it 4 years ago or so, he stepped down. I couldn't believe it. Like, what's going on? And I think it probably has something to do with this, what you're saying.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it was the best optimum timing or not, but at least at some point he voluntarily stepped down. There weren't even rumors of him being forced out or anything. Oh, no. I think it was on his own. Yeah, that's good.
It seems like George Washington wanted to err, if at all, on the side of leading.
Mm-hmm.
And James Dobson tended to err, if at all, on the side of staying.
That could be, yeah. That could be. There's a tension point there. Number three, you got to be secure enough to care more about the mission than you do about your own position or legacy. That's huge. Now, in our lifetime, I'll tell you one president I saw that had a real hard time letting go. Of course, the Constitution made him. Two terms is all you can do. You know who I'm talking about?
Not Bill.
Yeah, Bill. Do you remember what happened on Inauguration Day with Bill Clinton? Inauguration Day for... Well, that was his staff. I'm not sure if he put them up to that. But the very day that George W. Bush was being inaugurated, Bill Clinton left, as every president before him had done. No, that was his staff. Yeah, that's what he's talking about, taking the W's off. I don't know if he did that or stole China and all those other rumors, but what he did do that was public is at Andrews Air Force Base, where every other president in history had just quietly gotten on the plane and took his last ride home. He had a big band there. cameras wouldn't leave, man. It went on forever. I kept playing the theme, you know. It was like, it was kind of sad. Like, dude, it's over. You know? Yeah. Well, who are some examples in Scripture of these kind of leaders that stepped aside? They deferred to others. John the Baptist. I wrote him down. Great. What's his famous saying that sort of encapsulates the right attitude that we want to have about stepping aside? Stepping aside. Oh, yeah. And does anybody remember what he was replying to when that happened? When he said that? And what was their concern?
Jesus was baptizing more people.
Yeah, like, hey man, this guy's becoming greater than you. We can't. We got to stop this. And he goes, no, this is it, man. Yep. And he also said the thing about the joy of the best man for the groom. Yeah. Excellent. Who else?
Barnabas.
Barnabas, I wrote him down too. Why do you say Barnabas, Dwayne?
Well, the first missionary journey that they launched out, Barnabas was a leader in that. And then recognized that Paul was probably more gifted and more...
Isn't that something?
Anointed by God to turn the leadership over.
And when he turned the leadership over, he didn't disappear. He became Paul's right-hand man. They totally reversed roles. Isn't that wild? You don't see that very often, do you? Can you imagine, like, just some guy's a CEO just tells one of the guys on his team, like, you know, actually, you should be the CEO, but I'll tell you what, I'd love to be on your team. It might happen sometimes, but not too often.
I was going to say Peter.
Peter. Who did he defer to?
Paul.
Man. Acts 15 is profound humility on the part of a leader. Do you know what the human natural tendency would be if you were Peter and Paul came and said, actually, you don't quite have the gospel right?
Where were you?
Yeah, where are you? I walked with him. You never even met him, you know. He called me the rock. He said he'd build a church on me. You know, I mean, you could just see all the natural things you'd want to do. But he says, no. Our brother Paul is right. John deferred too.
And he was one of the three.
Mm-hmm.
Never asserted himself.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Although he did keep calling himself the one that Jesus loved most. Partial credit, yeah. Good, good, yeah. I put David on there. David's the only one I put on all three lists. Because he did that with Solomon. He might have waited a little too long, like James Dobson, but he did it. He handed over his authority. Some examples in history, we already mentioned Washington. I'll tell you another guy that comes to my mind in history is a guy who was carrying a huge burden of leadership and influence during World War II. But he did it in such a way that we wouldn't have even known his name by now if it weren't for an airlift named after him later, George Marshall. The guys who got all the glory were the frontline generals, Patton, Bradley, MacArthur, Monty. But he was their leader. And he was okay with them getting all the glory and credit. George Marshall's name was hardly ever in the paper.
Marshall's famous quote was, there's no limit to the good a man can do if he doesn't care who gets the credit. That was his quote.
And he lived it.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a clever saying. Did you guys all hear that?
No.
And Dawson Trotman used to quote him. Yeah.
There's no limit to the good a man can do if he does not care who gets the credit.
And he lived that. All these guys who worked for him, he let them be famous and get all the glory. Never clamored to get his name in the paper or have a movie made about him or a book written about him. And ironically, in the swan song years of his leadership, they named that airlift that saved Germany, saved Berlin after him, the Marshall Plan. Yeah. Good. All right. Well, axioms that you could write down a D next to for deferring if you want to. It's number 5, number 8, number 14, 18, and 22. You notice some of them have more than one. That's just my perception, but... So, here's the question on this one, F. The first was, where do I need to step up a little more intentionally? The second one was what? Where do I need to fall in line a little more wholeheartedly? This one is, where do I need to stride aside a little more freely? Now, we're about out of time, so I want to let you feel free to leave, but I will kind of address RJ's question with him and whoever who might want to stay, although you have the right to say you don't want to stay either, even though it was your question. And if anybody wants to discuss any of the particular axioms, I'm sorry for mismanaging the time, and I told you to put an asterisk by the axioms you wanted to discuss, and now we're kind of out of time. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to say a word of prayer, and you are free to go. If you want to stay in dialogue a little more on any of this stuff, RJ's questions, axioms, whatever, I'll be here until the last person is, all right? Lord, thank you for these friends, these kingdom-minded people, this chance to interact about what we've learned about leadership. And Lord, what we're learning, we're far from experts. Thanks for the lifelong and even eternity-long adventure it is to keep growing and learning and being changed by you. And thanks for the privilege we have of playing a small part in that as we lead others, whether it be formally and by position or informally, just through relationship. It's an incredible privilege, and Lord, we want to do it the best we can. So I pray that for each one of my friends here, and even for me, Lord, that some particular part of what we discussed might stick and even haunt us until we take action and follow through and grow in that particular area that you've isolated for us. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Good. Well, I'll give you a few moments to take off. If you want to hang around, great. Oh, yeah, you bet. I think the application part's pretty self-explanatory. I didn't comment on that. Just a couple of questions for you to consider. A good book. Yeah, the day I sit down and write a book will be the day that I've become a quadriplegic. I can dictate to others to write that. That's the only way I'm going to sit still long enough and stay focused enough. All right, good seeing you, Dave. That's right. There you go. See, it can be done. There you go. It's not copyrighted. Get it while the getting's good. And knowing me, I'll never get around to it. I saw a great, you know, speaking of Dobson, in one of his Focus on the Family magazines years ago, he was making fun of how Christian music had become such an industry. And it was a cartoon. He showed this guy in front of a piano with a mic, and he said, "Now I'd like to share the latest song the Lord gave me. And even though he gave it to me, it's copyrighted, and I'll sue your pants off if you use it without paying me."
Thanks, Tom.
All right, see you. Good seeing you, Barney. You bet. You bet, man. Thanks for all your work on this conference, dude.
Yeah, thank you for all your impact.
Good. Well, I hope we can... Yeah, and hope we can do that Cadets to Detroit thing we're talking about. That'd be fun. Okay. Oh, yeah, man. We'll make it happen. Hey.
How do you pronounce your last name?
It is Burke.
Burke, awesome.
Good job.
I really appreciate this.
Oh, good. Good. Oh, excellent. Well, that's good to hear, William.
The situation I'm in and the prayer I'm asking, this definitely brings a lot.
Wow. Praise the Lord. That's great. Well, God knew that. I can't say that I did.
I know. Thank you very much,
sir. Kevin. Good to meet you, man.
It's interesting because my next thing is there's a balance between ministry and future department headquarters.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Kind
of. Some of this fits, a lot of it fits in the Navy, but the price is higher and you can't count on the fact that anyone else is going
to
actually
cooperate. Yeah, that's right.
Be willing to stick with anything.
Yeah. Well, good to meet you, man. Short answer to what you were asking is for me, I came to realize, boy, I better listen to others. And I better make sure they know that I want to really hear the truth about that. Mm-hmm.